pleasure to welcome everybody. And as we start, it's not really a newsman, but want to welcome and pleasure, Dr. Sokolow, as we continue the Shiva de Nechemta, the Haftarat of comfort for the Jewish people. Vakasha.
Okay, thank you. So, one of the several striking literary features of this week's Haftarah is very reminiscent of the first of the seven Haftarot of consolation, and that is the use of duplication, right? The first of the seven Haftarot, the one that we read on the Shabbat immediately following Tisha B'Av, starts off with Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, yeah, the duplication of the call for consolation. And as we remarked at the time, the conventional understanding of repetition or redundancy is for the sake of reinforcement. So when you have a doubled verb, mot yumat, right, or sakol yisakel, right, or in this case, nachamu, nachamu, then it's the equivalent of emphasis, of lending additional emphasis to it. So here too, this week's Haftarah begins with Anochi, Anochi, hu menachem chem, right, with a duplication or repetition of the word of the word Anochi, the pronoun Anochi, representing, as it were, the voice of God himself. And in fact, just to jump a bit, if we just take a look, this is the first segment of the Haftarah, in which God once again offers the people of Israel words of comfort and consolation. If we just jump for a moment to the second segment, notice that again, it begins with hit oriri, right? Rouse yourself or really get up, right? So again, the duplication for the sake of emphasis. And if we just look a little further down in the Haftarah, we find yet again, Uri, Uri, Livshi, Uzech Tzion. Once again, awaken, awaken. So, as I said, one of the several striking literary features of this Haftarah is the use of repetition, duplication, redundancy, whatever you want to call it, and again, for the sake of emphasis. Okay. So here again, the Navi, speaking in the name of God, calls out to the people and offers them words of comfort. Mi'at vatir'i, what is it that you fear? Me'anosh, you're fearful of mortal, of a mortal man. Don't worry, yamut, right? He'll die. Ben Adam, again, if you're fearful of flesh and blood, Chatzir yinatein. We saw this a theme in the previous Haftarah, right? That people are like grass. It dries, it withers, and then a strong wind comes along and blows it away. So essentially, he's telling the people that they have nothing to fear. Vatishkach Hashem osecha. The reason that they got themselves into trouble is because they forgot God, their creator. Note shamayim v'yoseid aretz. This is a rather poetic way of describing creation, as though the universe consisted, as it were, of a tent. Right? The heavens were like a tent. Notesh amayim, that God, as it were, stretched out the heavens as though they were a tent above the earth. Vatfachei tamid kol hayom ipnei chamat hametzik, and because they abandoned God, because they forsook him, they had this fear, and they were in fear kol hayom, all the time, mipnei chamat hametzik, because of the rage or the anger of someone who was set to torment them, kasher konen lahashchit, who was preparing to destroy them. So to that, God now responds by saying, "Va'ayecha mata meitzik." It exists no longer. Mihar tzoele hi pateach, the one who was crouching as a captive is now set free. Lo yamut la shachat, he won't go down to the grave. lo yachsar lachmo, if he's hungry, if he's been starving, he will no longer be no longer want for food. Vanochi Hashem Elohecha, and God once again reminds the people, Roga Hayam Vayehemu Galav, that God is the one who, as it were, stirred up the sea and caused its waves to roar. What does it have to do with anything? It doesn't appear to have anything to do with the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the people of Judea. So what it may very well be is something that we have encountered in several previous haftarot, and that is harkens back to an ancient Semitic legend, or even myth, if you wish, that somehow the creation of earth was preceded by a battle that pitted God against the forces of the sea and several dragons, leviathans, who lived in the sea. So since there was a reference in the previous pasuk to Notesh Amayim V'Yosed Aretz, to God as the creator, and since that repeats itself in the following pasuk, Lintoash Amayim V'Lisod Aretz, it could very well be that every time you make a reference to God back during the time of creation, it's not surprising to find an allusion or a reference to his victory or triumph over the sea. Then the Haftarah moves into a description of the distress that the city of Jerusalem and its inhabitants suffered. And we already saw that it begins again with a doubling of the verb, hit-oruri, hit-oruri. The Navi calls upon the city of Jerusalem to arouse itself. Why? Meaning to stir itself from its passivity. Why? Because its time for redemption has come. It has already suffered through its prescribed punishment, asher shatit miyad Hashem, that they have, so to speak, drunk from a cup, kos chamati, from the cup of God's wrath, et kubat kos hatarela shatit matzit, that this cup of poison, ra'al in modern Hebrew is poison, right? As it were, symbolic of the catastrophes that befell the city of Jerusalem and its inhabitants, that since they have, as it were, already drunk this potion, so to speak, then they have suffered the punishment that has been prescribed for them. We'll spend a little time when we're done with the actual text talking about this imagery of punishment being a cup of something that has to be drunk. Ein menahela mikol banim yalada, that there is no one around to guide the city of Jerusalem, none of her children are present. Ein machazik biyada mikol banim gidela, she is, as it were, been separated from her children, so there is none to lead her, there is none to hold her hand. Shtayim heina kor otayach. Two things, the Navi says, have befallen the people of Jerusalem. Mi'anudlach, for which it requires consolation. And then strangely, he goes ahead and enumerates four things. Hashod, being despoiled, robbed by the enemy. Shever, could either mean something broken in the sense of destruction. Ra'av, famine. Cherev, the sword. You see the English translation sought to separate them. Even though in the Hebrew they're listed all together, the English sought to separate them, having shod and shever, rack and ruin, separated from the ra'av and the cherev, the famine and the sword. Could be that it was their intention to convey some sense of parallelism, that these are not four separate things, but these are two sets of similar or even identical things. Banayach, the children of the city of Jerusalem, that is its inhabitants, ulafu, they fainted. Shachavu barosh kol chusot. They're lying about in the public streets. Kito nichmar, like an antelope or a deer caught in a net. Hamleim chamat Hashem ga'arat Elohayich, and they are all suffering again from God's wrath. Therefore, we come now to yet another promise of salvation for the people of Israel and retribution against their enemies. Lachem, therefore, Shim'i nazot aniya. The Navi, the prophet, addresses the city of Jerusalem as one that is either unhappy or impoverished. Shechurat, it's stumbling around as though it were drunk. V'lomiayin, but it's not because it's intoxicated. Meaning, it's just simply suffered through such a crisis that it's, as it were, giving all the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. Therefore, ko amar Adonayich Hashem ve'lohayich yariv amo. Therefore, God makes them a promise that he will fight on their behalf, hine lakachti miadech, and that he will take away out of the hands of Jerusalem kos hatarela, that cup of a potion that he mentioned previously, et kubat kos chamati, this goblet filled with the wrath of God, lo tosifi lishtota od, they will no longer have to drink from it. So we see again this imagery that somehow drinking from the cup of wrath means to suffer the consequences of your actions, to suffer your punishment. And therefore, when God, as it were, takes the cup of wrath back out of your hands, that means that you have already suffered enough. The Samtia Biad Mogayach, and God goes a step further. Not only will he take this cup of wrath out of the hands of the people of Jerusalem, but he will place it in the hands of those who sought to destroy Jerusalem. Asher amru l'nafshei, who said, as it were, to the city, Shchivena Avora, prostrate yourselves before us so that we can, as it were, trample you. Vatasimicha aretz geveich, so that indeed you lay down on the ground before this enemy. V'chachutz la'ovarim, and you were like, they trod on you, they stepped on you as though you were paving stones. So this enemy that had tormented the Jewish people will now be forced, as it were, to drink from the same cup of wrath. It is to suffer the same fate that had been suffered now by the Judeans. And again, as we saw this shortly before, Uri, Uri, he calls again to the city of Jerusalem and he says, get up, awaken. Livshi ozech tzion. Arguably, the city of Jerusalem, or at least its inhabitants, had, since the time of the destruction of the city and their exile, worn prison garb, whatever captives wore. So now they're being told that their captivity is over and that they can dress themselves once again in in splendor. Livshi bigdei tif'arteich Yerushalayim ir hakodesh. And they can put on their majestic clothing, their royal cloak. Why? Ki lo yosif yavovach od arel v'tamei. Because arelim, uncircumcised, tmeim, impure, defiled, that is to say, the Gentile nations that had breached the walls of the city and destroyed it and exiled its inhabitants, will no longer be able to enter it. Hitna'ari me'afar, that if again Jerusalem and its inhabitants are lying on the ground in the dust, they should arise, they should get up off the ground, right? Kumi, right? Get up off the ground. Shvi Yerushalayim, and to sit on a chair. V'hitpatchi mosrei tzavarech shviya bat tzion. And he calls to Jerusalem the captive and says that the time has come to remove the bonds, the fetters, the chains from your neck, the chains of captivity. Ki ko amar Hashem. And he sums it up in this verse by saying, chinam nimkartem. you were sold, as it were, for nothing. Meaning there is no price due for your redemption. Therefore, since you were sold for no price, lo b'chesef tiga'elu, you can be redeemed for free, so to speak. Now, I'm sure you recognize the Hitna'arim e'afar as being the opening words of one of the stanzas of what is, without a question, probably the best known, the most celebrated, and maybe even the richest ode to the city of Jerusalem that was ever composed. And that is Lecha Dodi. Even though Lecha Dodi was ostensibly written in honor of the Sabbath Queen, if you look at it carefully next Friday night, you'll see that most of the stanzas speak directly to the city of Jerusalem. And it is rich in its use of images taken primarily from not just the book of Yeshayahu, but from the Haftarot of Nechama, from the Haftarot of Consolation. And Uri, Uri certainly is reminiscent of the stanza that begins, Hit Oruri, Hit Oruri. And then the one that follows it, Hit Na'ari Me'afar. So we can see where these prophecies of consolation have been a source of inspiration for religious poets, not only religious poets, for poets throughout the millennia. And I couldn't resist. I have a little link here, and the link is to you don't have to see it. You can just listen to it. So don't worry that you're not seeing anything. I'll let you see it. It's a rather interesting Israeli website that's called Zemer Reshet, a network for song. And they specialize in old Israeli songs. So here, in honor of this week's Haftarah, is a song. I assume you get the idea. Okay. Then the Navi moves to a somewhat more abstract offer of condolence or of consolation. And that is the notion that when Israel suffers, God suffers too. Kiko amar Hashem Elokim, God said as follows, Mitzrayim yarada mi barishon ala gorsham. All started way back when Jacob and his family went down to Egypt, la gorsham, right, to sojourn there, the Ashur, right, but the Assyrians, that's something much more recent, it happened during Yeshayahu's lifetime, the Ephes Ashako robbed them. The Ephes, again, getting nothing in return, meaning that they were the victims of spite. Va'ata, now says God, Malifol no'um Hashem. What do I gain here? Kilukacha michinam, because my people again has been carried off for nothing. Moshulav, those who rule over them now, Yehelilu, they mock them, no'um Hashem. V'tamid, and all day long, Shmi min no'atz. God says, my name is reviled. So that we've saw this theme many times in the past, not only in the book of Yeshayahu, we saw this theme already in the Torah. After the Jewish people sin with the golden calf, one of the arguments that Moses offers to God to spare them is to say, Lama yumru Mitzrayim lemor? Why should the Egyptians be able to say that the God of Israel wasn't able to sustain them in the wilderness? That he took them out of Egypt and they just simply, they all died out. So we find that God is responsive to this. We took note of this actually in our discussion of last week's Haftarah, that God, when he speaks about redeeming the Jewish people, says that if they do not have sufficient merit of their own to be redeemed, then he will add on the scale, as it were, the merit of their ancestors. And even if that merit is not sufficient, then what might yet tip the scale in their favor is God's intention to preserve his own integrity and the dignity of his own name. Therefore, he says here, Lachen yeda'a mishemi, therefore my people shall learn my name, not that they don't know his name in the sense of what he is called, but the name in the sense of what characterizes him, of what is his essence. Lachen bayom ahu, therefore on that day, he says, Anihu hamidaber hineni, that God, the one whom they know from history, will be the one who is present in their midst. That the God whom they know of, who has made promises to them, will now say, Hineni, I am here, I am near at hand. This too is a song, but I figure just, you know, one musical interlude is enough for the evening. Manavu al haharim raglei mevaser. The footsteps of the harbinger, of the messenger who comes to bring good news. Navu al haharim are welcome on the mountaintops. Mashmiya shalom, heralding good news, peace. Mevaser tov, mashmiya yeshua, announcing salvation or victory. Omer letzion, and how does he do this? By speaking to Zion, to Jerusalem, to the inhabitants of the city, and sending them a very brief message. Malach Elohayich. Surely when the city of Jerusalem was besieged and it was being destroyed, and when its inhabitants were taken into captivity, they thought, as it were, that the God of the Gentiles had somehow overcome their God. Now, the fortunes are being reversed. Malach Elohayich. God will once again resume his place on his throne and demonstrate his superiority over the enemies of Israel. Kol, right? Hark, right? Because we're anticipating word, news of salvation. Sofayich Nasu Kol. The lookouts stationed on the ramparts of the city have given a shout, Yachdav Yoranenu, and all together they shout. Why? Ki ayin ba'ayin yiru, because they with their own eyes will now be able to witness Vishuv Hashem Tzion, God's return to Zion and to Jerusalem. Therefore, the Haftarah concludes now with a note again of consolation and redemption. Pitzchu ranenu yachdav chorvot Yerushalayim. The prophet addresses the ruins of the city of Jerusalem, and he calls upon them to break out in song. Why? Kinicham Hashem amo, because God has comforted his people. Ga'al Yerushalayim, and he is in the process of redeeming the city of Jerusalem. How will he do it? Chasaf Hashem et zroa kodsho le'enei chol hagoyim. God will reveal, as it were, his might, his sacred might, in the presence, in the sight of all of the nations, particularly those who participated in the city's destruction. V'ra'u kol afisei aretz, so that to the very ends of the earth, everyone will be able to see et Yeshuat Eloheinu, will be able to witness the salvation of the people of Israel and their victory over their enemies. And therefore, he calls upon those who had entered the city to destroy it, suru, su'umisham, to turn away, to turn out of the city, to leave. Tame al tiga'u, not to be a defiling presence within the city. Therefore, tsu'umitocha, he calls upon the people of the city, as it were, to step back from the sources of impurity that are within it. Hibaru, and to cleanse themselves, to purify themselves. Why? Nose'e kalei Hashem, because they, as it were, are the bearers of God's vessels. What are God's vessels? Arguably, the Klei Hashem are the utensils, the vessels that were used in the service in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple. So that perhaps this is an allusion to the fact that that some of the temple utensils that were taken into captivity when the temple was destroyed will be returned to Jerusalem. And he says to the people additional words of comfort that they don't have to leave in haste. Right? And when they leave their places of captivity to return to Jerusalem, it will not be in flight. Why? Because they will be led by God, Uma'asivchem Elohei Yisrael. And somehow, in a manner that defies our experience and observation, God will be able to simultaneously lead them from the front as well as guard them at their rear. So that, as it were, they will be encircled by the presence of God, which will render them, on the one hand, invincible to their enemies, and on the second hand, the other hand, as we've seen in previous haftarot, remember the one which we spoke about, the way back from captivity to the land of Israel being flattened out, that things that were crooked will be straightened out, rechasim, hills will be flattened, and will be flattened down. So the presence of God surrounding them will not only be a protection to them, but it will also be a way that will ease and facilitate their return from captivity. This is essentially the Haftarah. And as I said, I wanted to focus this evening on a particular literary element in it, and that is the imagery of the cup of wrath. We saw several references, first to the fact that the people of Israel themselves had to drink from God's cup of wrath, and that symbolized their punishment. And then God said that he would take that cup out of their hands and give it over to their enemies, symbolizing that their enemies would now have to suffer some of the same consequences that Israel had to suffer previously. Now, the interesting thing is that it doesn't say what's in the cup. It's called Kos Chamato, the cup of God's wrath. It's called Kuba'at, the goblet, Kos Hatar Elah, the goblet that contains in it some sort of poisonous mixture, but it doesn't say what it is. So I would say that arguably, the cup of wrath, the kos chema, is a cup of wine. Why wine? Because nothing else in the ancient world could match wine for its value, for its significance, for its importance. Here we see, for example, in the instructions that God gave to Moshe regarding the sacrifices that were to be offered in the Mishkan. Notice what's highlighted. Every series of sacrifices contains two elements. One, mincha solet, a meal offering of fine flour. And the other is yayin lenesech, wine to be poured as a libation. So just as flour is important because it's from flour that we make bread, which is rightly called the staff of life. So offering fine flour on the altar as part of a sacrifice to God is literally rendering to God that which is most important to us in our lives. So it is if we pour to God a libation of wine. I might also point out parenthetically, milk was not a particularly popular beverage in those days. And for that matter, neither was water. I don't know whether they had already made some association between water and illness, or maybe they just simply saved the water for the animals or for agriculture. But it would seem that they drank wine the way we drink, I'm going to say, soda. Meaning, it was something that on the one hand, they drank regularly with every meal, and yet simultaneously, it was something that was reserved for special occasions. As we find here in the famous parable of Yotam, Yotam in a character in the book of Shoftim spins a yarn about halchu ha'itzim limshoach aleihem melech, that the trees of the forest wanted to appoint one of their number to be the king of the forest. So they approached the zayat, the olive tree, and they said, rule over us. But the olive tree replied and said, I can't, because I have a more important job to do. I have to produce my deshen. I have to produce my rich oil. Bi yechabedu Elohim va'anashim. Because both God and human beings were anointed with oil. Not God literally, but things that were holy. Holy objects were anointed with oil, and holy people, the Kohen Gadol, the king, were anointed with oil. Therefore said the olive tree, I can't waste my time on politics, right? I've got an important job to do. So they next approached the fig tree. And the fig tree said, me too. You want me to stop yielding my sweet, delicious fruit? So they turned to the geffen. They turned to the vine. And the geffen said, hechadalti et tiroshi, shall I stop producing wine? Hamisameach Elohim va'anashim. The description of wine as something that gladdens God and men. Now, obviously, gladdening God is an anthropopathism. It's a imputing to God human emotions, right? But it means it's just a recognition of the previous passages. That a libation of wine accompanied the sacrificial order. The argument is that if sacrifices are things that God finds pleasing, then if God asks for the sacrifices to be accompanied by a libation of wine, arguably God finds that too to be pleasant. We also find wine in negative or pejorative circumstances. Here we have instructions from God to the prophet Yirmiyahu. And God instructs the prophet, do not enter a house of mourning. Do not go to lament or to condole. That's a fancy English word for offer condolences to the people who are sitting Shiva, so to speak. Why? For I have withdrawn my favor from that people, my kindness and my compassion. Great and small alike die in this land. They shall not be buried. People will not lament them. They will neither cut themselves or shave their heads as signs of mourning for them. And what else do they do as signs of mourning? Lo yifrisu lahem al evel. They will not break bread with them. Velo yashku otam kos tanchumim. Neither will they offer them a cup of consolation. So here we have, if anything, the converse of the kos chema. The kos chema, the cup of wrath, symbolized punishment and suffering. Here we have an allusion to a kos tanchumim, to a cup of consolation. I included the last verse here, even though it isn't directly related to this, because it shows us a connection between wine and something else. It says that God says to the prophet Yirmiyahu, Hinni mashbit min hamakom hazeh le'enechem ubimechem. In your lifetimes and in your sight, I am going to banish from the city of Jerusalem kol sason v'kol simcha, kol chatan v'kol kala. Sound of mirth and gladness, the voice of bridegroom and bride. Another association that we have with wine is the association between wine and the marriage ceremony. If you stop to think about it, right? People get married because the groom gives the bride a ring and he recites a formula in which he pronounces their marriage, and they read a ketubah, a legal contract that binds them to each other as man and wife. Why do we make Kiddush? And the answer is because Kiddush, reciting a bracha over a cup of wine, lends any occasion a measure of significance, of importance, and perhaps even of sanctity. Indeed, we find the following passage in a midrash. Yilamdenu Rabbeinu, the student, said to the teacher, please instruct us. Misha ta'am ta'am shemen, ketzad tarich levarech. What bracha should be recited over oil? Now, I know what bracha you recite over an olive, right? If you pluck an olive from an olive tree, or even if you eat one out of a can, right? The bracha is borei pri ha'etz. But what bracha do you make over oil? And the answer is, the rabbis taught us, hato'en ta'am shemen, somebody who doesn't merely put oil on food, but as it were, drinks oil, recites the bracha borei pri ha'etz, meaning no special bracha was assigned to oil, even though we saw that oil plays an important role. Oil is used to anoint kings. It's used to anoint high priests. It's used to anoint the utensils of the Mishkan. But no special bracha was assigned to it. However, we say, al hayayin, if you drink wine, which again, if you pluck a grape off a vine, you make a borei pri ha'etz. But if you squeeze wine from grapes, then it is assigned a special bracha, borei pri ha'gafen. And they ask the teacher, ma ra'a hayayin shetehe birchato mishuna mikol hamashkin? Why is wine the exclusive, the sole beverage to have been assigned its own special bracha? And the answer is, there are two answers, but the main answer is, shahayam mitnaseich al gabeha mizbeach. Simply because wine was the only liquid that was used and poured out as a libation over the Mizbeach, accompanying korbanot, accompanying sacrifices. But a cup of wine also served another purpose. This isn't quite biblical, although it could very well be a takeoff on the Kos Hatar Elah, on the cup that held some sort of potion in it. This is a Talmud that tells us as follows. When one was led out, when someone was led out to be executed, Hayotzei Lehareg, somebody was convicted of a capital crime and was being taken out to endure one of the Arba Mitot Beit Din, one of the four different capital punishments that were inflicted by a Jewish court. The Gemara says, Mashkin oto korat shel levona v'chos shel yayin. He was given, before his punishment was administered, he was given to drink a goblet of wine containing a measure of levona, of frankincense. Why? Kedei shetitaref da'ato. Because somehow that numbed his senses. So we see here that wine, as an intoxicant, right? Maybe as even as an anesthetic use. And we also have the following significance attached to wine by Maimonides in his Guide to the Perplexed, in discussing the ta'am nizirut. What is the reason, the essential reason behind the value that the Torah obviously places upon somebody becoming a nazir? Now, a nazir, there are many things that a nazir is prohibited from doing. He's prohibited from approaching a corpse, right? There are a lot of different things, one of which is that he is prohibited not only to drink wine, but to eat any product that's made from grapes. And Maimonides says that the object of nizirut, he says, mevo'ar ma'od is obvious. V'hu, and what is it? Haprishut min hayayin. That it keeps people away from wine. Wine is an intoxicant. Wine, even as an anesthetic. Asher hifsid min harishonim v'ha'acharonim rabim. Because, says Maimonides, it's well known, both in the ancient world, the Rishonim, as well as in what was for him contemporary or modern times, ha'acharonim, well known that wine ruins people. And he cites a couple of biblical verses, Atzumim kol harugav, many strong people have been slayed by wine, Gam ela bayayin shagu, people who, because they became intoxicated, made egregious mistakes. Uba midin hanizirut, ma shetir'em me'isur kol asher ye'asem migefen hayayin. And the reason that the nazir is prohibited not only from wine, but from eating anything that comes from that grew on a vine, is, he says, laharchaka yeteira, in order to, as an extra stringency, as an additional precaution, to keep him away from sheyaspik laadam mimenu hadavar hatzarich. That if you would say to him, you know, it's okay, you can have grapes and you can have raisins and you may, can even have mead, right, fermented raisins, but you just can't have wine, right? Much better, says Rambam, if we say, don't go near anything that even resembles or related to wine. So we can see, kehanishmar mimenu, because somebody who abstains from drinking wine, Nikra Kadosh, is called holy. V'husam b'madregat kohen gadol b'kdusha. And Maimonides says that his sanctity is equal to that of the kohen gadol. ad shelo yitma afil yitame afilu la'aviv ulimo kamohu, because only two people are prohibited from becoming defiled by the corpses of their parents, a Kohen Gadol and a Nazir. Zot hagidula mipnei sheperash min hayayin. And why is the Nazir entitled to this honor? Because simply he abstains from wine. So we see that wine is a mixed bag, right? Wine gladdens God and man. Wine is used to accompany the Karbanot on the Mizbeach. But then on the other hand, wine is also an intoxicant. Wine leads people into making egregious errors. So, punishment on the one hand and redemption on the other are compared to wine. The wine of the punishment, the wine in the cup of wrath, is like the wine that intoxicates and can lead people astray, while the wine in the Kos Tanchumim, the wine that was offered to mourners after a funeral, was perhaps the wine that, well, hard to say that under those circumstances it gladdened them, but maybe it was given to them for its anesthetic value. But I thought that if I was talking about the cup of wrath, I should find some significance to attach to the cup as well. And it's interesting that apparently the word kos, cup, is a figure in biblical poetry, primarily in the book of Tehillim, but elsewhere as well, where it is used in synonymous parallelism with a portion. If you want to say, this is your portion, then a way to say it in biblical Hebrew is, that's your cup. Now, we have something similar in English too. If you want to say that somebody likes to do something, somebody does something well, we call it his cup of tea. Why do we call it his cup of tea? We call it his cup of tea because just like a cup of tea is something that people enjoy and it's easy to make or whatever it is, so something that somebody enjoys doing and does well, so we say by analogy it's his cup of tea. But we still retain that notion of the cup of something. So here too, both in Tehillim, in several verses in Tehillim, as well as at somewhat greater length here in a portion of the prophecy of Yirmiyahu, we find references to the cup, and specifically to a cup of wine, and even more specifically, kos hayayin hachema hazot, right? Confirming our suspicion that the cup of wrath held wine. Here it explicitly is called a cup of wine of wrath. Okay? And we find that taking the cup, v'akachet hakos miyad Hashem, that taking the cup from the hand of God and drinking it or giving it to others to drink is essentially saying that they are going to receive their portion of whatever is becoming to them. So it is that in the future, we look forward to God offering us as though we were avelim, as though we were mourners over Jerusalem and over the temple, just as the destruction of the temple and our exile was ushered in by our having to drink from the cup of wrath. We look forward to the day on which our salvation and redemption and the return to Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple will be ushered in by our drinking once again from a cup handed to us by God, but now it would be the cup of Tanchumim, the cup of consolation, and not the cup of wrath. Let's see what we have here. No. Okay, Socrates and a cup of hemlock. Yes, people appreciated the song. Okay. Generally, as I said, the people drank wine freely, and it probably was inexpensive wine. I don't know whether to compare it to Manischewitz or to Thunderbird. I don't know what Thunderbird is, but if you spend time on the Bowery, you learn what Thunderbird is. And then they probably had finer, better, wines that were aged longer that were used for special occasions. Indeed. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Of course, that was true in the Middle Ages also. That's the Rama's famous, tshuva about wine, that the Jews in France were drinking basically non-Jewish wine, Stam Yenam, and he has a tshuva. Well, they consider it like water, because the water in the Middle Ages, I don't think people drank water too much. Dr. Sokol, I hope you're enjoying the water. But so I think that was true, not just in, of course, that was true in the medieval period too. Thank you. And I guess I'm still a little bit young, because I don't recognize those songs at all. Everybody says oldie but goodie. I don't know. I don't. That were not when I was a kid, that they didn't play those songs for me. They played other Zionistic songs or whatever. I mean, you can tell it sounds very, you can tell the people who are singing it are not, didn't learn in yeshiva. What can I say? But as you said, they're inspired songs across the board, not just religious songs.
But some of them did learn in yeshiva.
Okay. And, okay. And left afterwards or whatever. And it just has that sound. It's not fair to judge that way. But you know what I'm saying? You listen to that music. It's sort of, it's very interesting. Well, I had not heard that before. I didn't know that.
You can tell that they're not your standard yeshivas because they pronounce most of the words correctly.
Right. Okay. Yes. Molly. Yes. I sang Bnei Akiva, but very different songs. So I went to Bnei Akiva. They didn't sing those songs. They were at the Vavi. I don't know. They did different songs of Bnei Akiva when I went. Okay.
Yeah. We also sang Shtege Dot LaYarden.
Right.
You see, okay. Good. I'm in the younger crowd here tonight.
No, that's a Beitar song. That's not Bnei Akiva.
But we got sang a theme.
Really? Okay. I won't ask what shevet you're in. I used to know all the shvatim, like 15 above me, whatever, but not anymore. I don't have a clue. What I'm sort of out of touch with whatever. I guess if once you hit a certain age and you're Bnei Akiva, you didn't make Aliyah, you're sort of, it's a whole different ball game. Anyways, thank you very much, Dr. Sokolow. Tomorrow morning, talking about Bnei Akiva, not exactly, but Ari Shvat, I think, who also went to Bnei Akiva as a kid, who runs the Rav Kook archives, more importantly, and he'll be starting a shiur on Arut HaTshuva. We mentioned earlier, I mentioned before, today, well, not today anymore, but today, before it turned dark, was the 86th Yortzeit, Gimel Elul, the 86th Yortzeit of Rav Kook. That's just coincidental to this. But he'll be starting a five-part series tomorrow. I think he laid out this topic. Can tshuva be not depressing? Yeah, tshuva should not be depressing. Okay, cool. Okay, that's tomorrow. And at 11 o'clock tomorrow night, the Parsha Shiur, 8:30, Rav Yaakov Jaffe from Maimonides, Boston, will be giving the Parsha Shiur tomorrow night. He'll be doing the Pirkei Avot Shiur Friday morning, of course. And Sunday morning, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott from Teaneck, where I see some of the people are tonight. Rabbi Helfgott will be using an SAR. We'll be starting a four-part series on Sefer Yonah. That's at 10 a.m. And Rabbi Liebtag will be moving back to a sort of time we're doing for 11:15, not at 11. So we'll have time between the two classes. That's 11:15 on Sefer Dvarim. Monday, we have two classes, 11 and 1, two new for our Elul series. Professor Reinhold from Bernard Revel, where Moshe Sokolov, I'm sure, knows very well, will be giving a three-part series on the philosophy of tshuva. And then Jennifer Raskis and Rebecca Winter will be doing a four-part series on tshuva in Tanakh. So that will be Monday at 11 and 1, 11 a.m., 1 p.m. Eastern time. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful night. Do you have any comments, questions? Do you want to sing any songs? Do I have a kumtis now and old songs and hitorari, right? So always every daftor, think of the chadodi, of course, and Okay, everybody. We hope to see you soon. If you haven't registered, of course, you know, you can, you have to register for all these. I mean, I asked, it'd be nice if you register for the program. You can do one registration for all, which I know many of you have done, or you can register for each individual one. Doesn't really matter. I think it's pretty quick, the registration, but still. And we look forward to learning with you. Thank you very much, everybody.
Yes,
go ahead. Okay, Yashar Koach. Okay, nice to see you. How are you?
Baruch Hashem.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much. Very good.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Good night, Lila.
Fascinating.
I know Kelman. That song.
Yes. Okay.
Rabbi Kelman, did you ever consider doing a Hebrew song session?
No. I didn't like, it's just not something, you know, I think of. Like,
I think there are people who would, you know, the history of Israeli music, and there are people who I think would like it. I would.
It's funny, you know, at our oldest son's bar mitzvah, we decided we did, like, it was in the winter. So we did on Saturday night, we had like a malam malka. We sort of said, you know, 11 o'clock, hey, we're going to sit around the circle, have a kumzitz a little bit, you know, but I don't know how those work online, you know,
but they do. Dancing together, you know, everyone just has to sing at home alone because
everybody sing at home alone, but you have to have your camera on, you know, to get the
yeah. So the person who's leading it, you hear. For my husband's 70th birthday, I actually found this Israeli guy who knew all of these old songs, and we sat on chairs. We didn't sit on the floor, but that's essentially what we did do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was amazed. He said, are you sure people are going to know these songs? He was amazed that there was a group of people in New York City who knew all of these songs. This guy was Israeli. It's very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, well, a lot of fun.
We had, of course, last year, we had Chazan Malavani. We did, on the Nusach HaTfilah. That's a little bit different. I understand.
That's not, no, I wasn't.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a shame.
Chazanis isn't popular as much as it once was. I know, but anyways, that's a whole different story. Okay. Okay. If you want to organize it, the Hebrew Kumzitz night, somebody's got to play a guitar, you know, got to get, you know.
Maybe you can do something, the history of Israel through song.
Yeah. I mean, did you
matter what? The expert on that has passed away. Sherwood Goffin. You know, was.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah, but I don't know who could do that. My guy, first of all, maybe he does play guitar, but I don't know that he knows the history. I could ask.
Well, who is the guy who, who's the, I don't know if he's still there, the Chazan and Avi Weiss. I mean, Avi Weiss is not the rabbi really anymore either. I guess Rabbi Emeritus in Ishul. Kranzler, right? That's the Chazan, right? So he's also.
Chaim Kranzler. I don't know if he knows.
I don't know if he's into Israeli history.
You mean all the old, yeah, I mean, yeah.
I don't know these songs. I know I didn't. I'm listening to the song tonight. I know he, or I never heard it.
You know, Finjan song. You know,
which song?
Yes. In my house on Yom HaTzmaut, we played a tape when my son was growing up. So there are 10 songs he knows. More than that, probably not.
Zoom, golly, golly. I don't know. I don't know what song.
That's my grandmother saying.
Okay.
Right. Rosa.
Yeah. Sort of.
I made
Rosa,
a song.
Rosa, right? That's right. How it goes? Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Oh,
so right.
I guess
right.
I know more than I thought. Okay.
See?
I do.
Right.
All right. Anyways.
All right.
Okay. Lila Tov, everybody. Hope to see you in the morning.
Lila Tov.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It's good. You can